Welcome to Mastering the Attention Economy podcast. I'm your host, Ari Lewis. Human attention is a scarce resource that millions of companies across the globe are fighting for. Once a week, I interview entrepreneurs, executives, and industry leaders on how they earn attention for their brands using social content and media. To learn more about my work, visit arilewis.com and subscribe to my twice-a-week newsletter on how to earn attention for your brand. Today's guest is Candace Amos. Candace is a director of audience development and social media for The Daily Beast. In this episode, we discuss growing an audience using non-paid acquisition channels, best practices for audience retention, and why Candace transitioned from a reporter to the business side of media.
Hello, I'm so excited to be here.
So, you know, I always like to jump into things with guests. You know, you started your career as a reporter at the New York Post. That was one of, you know, your earlier jobs. And one of the things you did there was cover crime. So, you know, going right into it, you told me a really interesting story that you used to literally walk into crime scenes and there was, you know, could be gunshots just that happened mere minutes before that, or even you might be hearing gunshots after you're there and still reporting. Can you share with us that experience and sort of, you know, how it ended up shaping you as a person in your career, both personally and professionally?
Yeah, I mean, at that time, I was a recent college graduate and I just wanted to get in the game and I was willing to do anything. And the New York Post is definitely the place for that. but it definitely taught me to kind of just see difficult things through. And so I would be reporting on shootings. I remember one of the saddest stories was a family in the Bronx died in a fire. And I got to the scene as they were pulling bodies out. And the visual is forever etched in my mind. It was really difficult emotionally as a reporter. But to me, it was important to kind of get that news out to my community. So I'm grateful for that experience because it definitely opened my eyes to different parts of journalism and it toughened me up.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously that sounds like a harrowing experience. And you talked about getting, you know, toughened up. I think one of the conversations that I've had with many people, and we've seen this in the media, you know, people talk about Substack, how it's, you know, mostly made up of white, you know, male writers, unfortunately. You're one of the few, you know, people of color in media, unfortunately. And you know, can you talk about sort of how that experience helped you in empowering yourself? And, you know, you talked with me before this about it's so important to bring out your individual traits and feel empowered. You know, can you really combine those two things? Talk about how that experience helped you become empowered. And now, you know, you have this really great position at the Daily Beast and you know how you got there from that.
Yeah, I definitely felt empowered to kind of power through, if that makes sense. So at the New York Post, they would send me on all night stakeouts out of state, and I'm just somewhere completely foreign to me and would just have to, you know, kind of pull it from somewhere to get the job done. And I just kept that with me all the way through. And, you know, again, with embracing who I am, there are certain stories that I can go to that maybe a white male reporter can't go to because the people that they would have to speak to wouldn't feel safe with them. So I use that to my advantage, being able to talk to people who look like me, because those are the types of stories that we were covering at that time. And as a journalist, you know, when a certain celebrity dies or a famous person and they're a person of color and I know their complete background, I don't have to do the research that someone else would have to do. I can literally get in there, write what I have to write, publish, and go. So I think, you know, being connected to my community is important. It's important, and it's important for representation and for people who are reading the news to know that it's coming from a genuine place of someone who is knowledgeable.
Yeah, and I think that's a good segue into, and I don't know if you can share sort of the makeup of the readers of the Daily Beast, but I'm sure, you know, there are a good amount of it that are, you know, people of color. How does being, you know, an African-American woman help you in being able to, you know, think about that audience and acquire that audience? But also, what can the, you know, whether you're in content, community, media, if, you know, you are a white male like myself, what can we do to think about acquiring, you know, underrepresented minority audiences, because I know, you know, it's a valuable audience to have, and having a more diverse audience is obviously better from an advertising point of view and from a membership point of view as well.
Yes, I agree with all of those points, and it shows that, okay, there's opportunity for expansion. So if I'm covering the same, you know, if I'm covering Ariana Grande 24/7 and no one else, but, you know, someone like a Lizzo pops up and you completely miss that moment, you could have grown that audience there. So that's kind of how you have to look at it. People of color, people that look like me, we can't be ignored. We read the same things that everyone else does. We're just as engaged in, you know, the news cycle as everyone else. So I think that it's important to prioritize that group, especially, you know, when we look at what's happening now, and we see people of color are so civically engaged, especially with this election. I think it's important to kind of prioritize the stories that would help them, that would benefit them. Yeah, I hope that answers your question.
No, that definitely answers my question. And I don't want to turn into a political conversation, but I do just want to ask, do you think Biden being elected hurts the Daily Beast or, you know, helps the Daily Beast from an audience development point of view? I know a lot of people are like, oh, Trump, this Trump boost they talked about in media and content. But then some people are also like, oh, he's so, you know, caused so many conflicts, so many battles with reporters that it'll be easier to cover a Biden White House. So don't give a political answer, just a factual, like objective answer on that.
I'm not going to be political. I'm speaking from a strictly content perspective. And I will bring it back to 2016 when Hillary Clinton lost. I was working at the Daily News at that time, and we were on a high. And then when she lost, like literally traffic plummeted, everything went south. Now this time around, things are still holding steady. You know, traffic is still pretty strong, and we have not seen anything because we're covering it from a different angle. Now we're kind of looking at, you know, the Daily Beast is very liberal leaning. So we're covering, okay, what is the next step? And President Trump continues to give us content because he's always tweeting. So, I mean, and he's always introducing us to new characters. So now it's all about, you know, Newsmax and all, you know, all these other outlets that people are using to kind of like get away from mainstream media. So I think if you continue to follow the ball and just, you know, stay current with what how his attention is diverting, I think that you'll be okay. And honestly, my editor-in-chief, we had a conversation before all of this, and he was like, look, whoever the president is, we're going to cover him, you know, just as tough as Trump and anyone else. So that definitely reassured the newsroom that we still have to dig for those stories. We still have to find those sources and, you know, do whatever we can to bring the news to the people.
Yeah. And I'm somewhat glad that, you know, from a media point of view, that Trump won't be president and is starting this new media company. Now he's saying he's starting. I think it's going to provide a lot of good fodder, and I'll probably need to get someone onto the podcast to just talk about Trump's new media company. So I'm excited to cover it and write about it. But, you know, we touched on, you know, reaching the African American audience and, you know, women and, you know, not the white male audience, obviously. And one of the things you do is you write 32 Letter, which is a, you know, publication for black women. You know, can you talk about what that is? But I'd also love to hear from you, you know, and your role at the Daily Beast, as well as your role in writing that, you know, do you think audience development and sort of these publications are going down the route of, you know, a large publication with like these niches that are targeting specific audiences, or do you think, you know, that anyone can go to, you know, a Daily Beast or a New York Times and they don't have to be specifically targeted because just their reporting is their reporting and it's good? You know, what are your thoughts on that? But start with, you know, 32 Letter.
So 32 Letter is a website for black women, giving career advice and financial advice, things that I didn't know. So growing up, no one really, you know, pulled me to the side and said, hey, this is what you do after college. It was just get to college and then you've already made it. And obviously, we all know that's not true. So I wanted to provide a blueprint for people because people are constantly coming up to me and talking to me and saying how proud they are of me. And I'm like, hey, I'm not doing anything special. I'm just working. But I realized that a lot of Black women don't have the tools to really get into the rooms that they want to be in. So by creating that website, I'm answering people's questions that they always ask me in article form. And, you know, hopefully giving good advice. Especially when it comes to finances. And I remember when I was first starting out and I barely had, you know, two coins to rub together. And I'm like, okay, what do I do? Do I go to work and not eat, or do I, you know, not pay this? So it's just a lot of questions that people have starting out. And that's why I wanted to create that website. Now, as far as audiences are concerned, I definitely agree that you should focus more targeted. And the reason why I say that is just this year alone, once we started to double down on the content that our audience really craves, we've seen our growth on Instagram explode. Not just followers, but, you know, clicks to the website, people sharing our content, and actually the deep engagement that we wanted. We would post 2 years ago, we would post so much and people wouldn't comment. Now we have this community of people. I'll go to a post that was posted an hour ago, come back, and there's 200 comments with people just going back and forth. And that has definitely boosted our membership, because most of our articles are locked on the website. So you have to be a member to read the full article. So I definitely think, you know, figuring out what your audience likes, because we cover a wide array of topics. We cover travel, entertainment. But obviously, travel isn't going to be, you know, as popular as politics, you know, or, you know, world news isn't going to be as popular as U.S. news. So understanding what is driving new audiences and then slowly introducing them to other things on the website, I think is what works.
Got it. And, you know, you can talk about this from the Daily Beast perspective or 32 Letter or both, but how do you think about it? Is it, okay, here's our data, and then we see, you know, people are engaged on XYZ, we're going to double down on that and create a strategy and tactics around it? Or is it more like, okay, we have engagement here, but we also have this thesis that, you know, XYZ will read it if we do this? You know, how do you think about that? And then, yeah, can you talk about, like, you know, you talked about more engagement, like tactically what that looks like, if you don't mind?
Yeah. Well, definitely understanding analytics. Analytics will lead the way, and that will tell you your full picture, your story of where you want to go. And the work that we want to kind of publish, but we know isn't going to drive, you know, as much engagement, is still important. So we don't not publish that. But we know that we have to lead with, you know, the stories that people are actually signing up to become members, because that's the most important part of the business right now. So I think that is key, understanding, like we have like certain authors that we know when they publish, they're going to drive signups, just period. And then we have others that we know that, okay, this is just good for the moment and we can't ignore this moment. So I guess it's just like a mix of everything, and you just kind of just weigh it out. I look at analytics every single day. I weigh those numbers month to month and just kind of see what's working, what isn't working. And again, our newsroom is very engaged. Everyone is looking at how they can improve and how they can do better, because it's all about servicing our audience. We know that they're paying for this product. So we want to make sure that we're giving them quality news and information.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But I guess my question on that is like, how do you know for the analytics of something that for an audience you don't know about that you think you can reach, right? Because, like, you know, we're talking about, right, like people of color, you know, if you think like, we want to, you know, they're not engaging as much because we just aren't serving them. Like, do you ignore that market, or do you run like experiments to go like, you know, we want to reach this group? Or it might be like, people in the Midwest don't read us because we're liberal and it's on the coast, but we think there's a pocket of people in the Midwest who will read us. Like, is that a focus, or you're just really more looking at the analytics and thinking, okay, if we keep doubling down on this and keep focusing on this, you know, we'll maybe find those fringe people because we're doing good work and they just haven't found us yet.
Right. Well, it's definitely a business. So the bottom line is important. We want to continue to push content that we know readers are going to become members and, you know, sign up and be long term with us. So that is always the mission. We don't ignore certain groups. But again, some things are timely and some things aren't. Like, I always get pitches from people and I'm like, this story would be great in June, but not right now. Because, you know, it's missing that angle, it's missing that hook. And there's so much going on right now that is actually, you know, boosting what we're trying to promote, which is membership. That is first and foremost. But as far as discovering new audiences, this year in particular was a turning point, especially when it comes to the whole racial movement. We have done a great job at reaching out to more writers of color and letting them bring the stories to us. Like, you know, obviously our editor-in-chief is a white man. He probably doesn't know what a, you know, 32-year-old Black woman is interested in. So obviously he's relying on a freelancer or some, you know, a tip from a reader to kind of understand what's important to that audience. So again, being very receptive, we've done so much work this year alone in that. My team is super diverse. So it's myself. We have two Black women and a woman who is Filipina. So, you know, we're making strides in that area. And as far as like diverse content pools, you know, we aren't going to go super diverse because there's just a baseline of content here. We know it's politics, you know, U.S. news, and, you know, we dabble in other things like travel from time to time, but we're not going to venture off, you know, too far. That makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I don't know if you know the stats here or if you can share with this, and if you can't, no worries. But like, I've always known of the Daily Beast, but the only time I really read the Daily Beast is when like Molly Jong Fast tweets. She has like a huge following and I always see her on Twitter. You know, do you find that like those reporters, and I don't know if she's the only one, but like with like huge, yeah, with those huge audiences, does that really make a difference to, you know, audience engagement? Or is most of it just, you know, from you guys putting out a lot of content and that really isn't actually driving the ball as much as maybe I think it is?
Well, we definitely have some superstars as far as writers are concerned, and Molly is one of them. And she definitely helps support the Beast, and we're so grateful for her talent as a writer. She's super engaged with her audience, be it on Twitter or Instagram, and that definitely helps. And I think that she honestly does a great job at just writing the content that they need. Because sometimes it's not just about news. It's not just about putting out information. It's about providing some type of, you know, ease or, you know, solace to your audience where they feel like, okay, all is well. I'm going to be okay. And I think that she does a good job at that. And other writers should be thinking that way. You know, you shouldn't be writing for a particular publication. You should be writing for a certain audience. And once you figure out what that audience needs, if you're an opinion columnist or whatever, you'll be a better servant as a writer, and you'll be more successful. So yeah, those voices definitely help the Beast. And we, you know, on the social team, we're constantly promoting our articles on Twitter. Because we know that that's what the audience loves.
Yeah, so I think that's a good, you know, transition into what is like the customer, or I shouldn't say the customer, the audience journey look like? You know, where does, you know, a person typically, you know, find the Daily Beast? Then, you know, where do you want them to go next? Is it like they find you through social, then you want them to like subscribe to your email newsletter and then maybe become a paying member? Like, can you just share? And I know you probably can't go into specifics around conversion and maybe the secret sauce, but like at a high level, what you can share, can you share like what the ideal journey looks like?
Yeah. So the Daily Beast obviously isn't the Washington Post or the New York Times. We haven't been around as long, but we get a lot. We get a huge, huge number of readers from SEO. Then if they aren't finding us that way, they're finding us on Twitter. You know, someone with a huge following is sharing our content. And the baseline is that we know that, you know, a good third of our content that is published every day is locked, and we want people to read it. And in order for them to read it, they have to become members. So that's the whole thing. We get them to sign up to our newsletters. We have different types of newsletters that go out every day. And then from there, once they, you know, we establish ourselves in their inbox, they decide, okay, I want more of this, so I'm going to pay that $25 a year to become a member. And yeah, that's pretty much how it works.
I don't know if this is within your purview, so if it's not, let me know. But do you look at, you know, your free journalism as a way to acquire customers, as a way to, you know, make money, or a bit of both? I've, some of the people I've had on here, both who are in product companies as well as the media companies, some of them talk about content as like a negative customer acquisition channel, where they're actually getting paid to acquire customers because they're making money on the advertising side, but they don't look at it as a as an ad play. They look at it as a way to acquire customers for a product. How do you view it?
Right. Well, it's definitely the baseline of our business. Again, as I stated, we want people to sign up to become members. You know, that drives everything. It's also, our business is also supported with ads. But membership is key because that shows loyalty. And yeah, I think that answers your question.
Yeah, no, that did a good job of answering the question. So I know we touched on this a bit with 32 Letter and Daily Beast, but when you guys look at sort of niche publications and like niche audiences, does the Daily Beast the best way to word this is, do you look at, you know, maybe like acquiring different publishers to reach certain niche audiences, or is it something where if you guys want to expand into certain verticals, you try to do it yourself? And do you think like those verticals are better served as not being part of the Daily Beast, but being, you know, better served as like under that, you know, original name, so to keep that vertical audience? I know that was a bit of a weirdly worded question, so hopefully you understood it.
Yeah, we are definitely not there yet as far as spinoffs from the Daily Beast, but we work with a ton of partners. So we work with Smart News, Apple News, MSN, and people find us there. And then people are like, what the heck is the Daily Beast? And then they come to our website and, you know, get familiar. So we have like several partner channels that we work with. And we just, you know, give them our feeds and our content goes through their website. So
yeah, that's helpful. And can you talk a bit about the relationship between like the audience development team and the reporters? You know, obviously Daily Beast is a very legitimate publication. No one ever questions like that you guys are pay to play, like some of, you know, the industry trade pubs out there. But, you know, is it the reporters have like free rein to, you know, write what their beat is? Or are you ever like giving them insight, feeding them information about like, and we'll just use Trump because that's an easy example. It's like stories about Trump get more engagement. If you can try to find a story about Trump, that's better than, you know, writing a story about a different side of politics. You know, what does that dynamic look like?
Well, that is something we don't do. We don't tell reporters what to write about. They go directly to the editors, pitch the stories, and then I'm presented the stories that are being, you know, pitched in meetings every morning. But what we do is tell them what types of headlines they should use, what types of keywords they should put in, and things like that. But we don't really tell people because you can't really predict it. You don't know. And Trump as a topic is honestly so just, what's the word I'm looking for? Everyone's writing about Trump. So it's not going to be a huge pull unless it's breaking news for SEO anyway. But yeah, they're aware of what stories drive the most readers. So I think they just kind of keep that in mind. And the editors are very good at having those, you know, those conversations with the writers so they don't waste their time.
Yeah. And I know we talked about this in the beginning, but I don't think I asked it directly. Like, how did being a writer, you know, help you become, you know, an audience development person? And also, you know, how did you decide to transition from writing to audience development? I know you do a bit of writing on Daily Beast, but obviously it's not your primary job.
Yeah, so that's a great question. So basically, the whole transition started when I was at the Daily News and I was offered a social media position. And I said, okay, sure, why not? So I ended up being there. I was there for 3 years. And then I didn't know what was next. I got laid off. I got laid off in 2018, and it was my first time being laid off. And it was just a really confusing time. So then I came to the Daily Beast on a part-time basis. And I was working with this social media team that did a whole lot of audience development work. And I said, oh, okay, wow, this is what audience development is. So I did that. I was at the Daily Beast on a part-time basis for 6 months. And then I just said, let me just dive in completely with audience development. And I went over to the Daily Mail. And I was hired as an audience development editor, and that was like serious boot camp. We had no conversations with the social media team. It was all audience development, and it was all about, getting our work on different platforms. And I learned so much at the Daily Mail, which is interesting. And then I came back to the Daily Beast, where a role opened up to be the deputy director of audience and social. So I did that for 3 months, and then the director left, and I was promoted into her role. And yeah, the rest is history. I feel like, with this industry, for me, I feel like obviously we know people get laid off all the time, but social and audience, selfishly, I have to say, is a really safe place to be because it's such a complicated topic and it takes a lot of time to kind of dive into. You got to understand the history of, organizations. Like right now, I'm doing a complete analysis from last year to this year and kind of looking at how we've grown in different areas. And if you aren't willing to dive in and really understand those numbers and what they represent, then it may not be for you. So once I realized it came easy to me and I really like doing the little calculations and doing presentations and all of that, I decided to stick with it. And I'm grateful because you know what? I kind of get a chance to chime in on, edit meetings and ideas and things like that, business meetings. I think, you're kind of like right in the middle of everything that's happening. So yeah.
Awesome. So as we begin to wrap things up, I end with, my final question that I ask all the guests, which is, what is one lesson from your career that you'd like to, share with the listeners?
So one lesson that has stayed with me, when I was at the New York Post, my editor at the time was Michael Heckman, very old white guy, but he was like a father figure to me in a way. Like he just say the craziest things all the time. And one thing he always told me is don't ever feel greater than being able to report on a fire. Because as you know, reporters, when they get to a certain level, some things are beneath them. And I use that in my career because when I faced that layoff and I had to figure out what was my next move and that big job opportunity didn't present itself, I took a part-time job and I was literally working weekends only and filling in whenever I can. And it was really a step down because I went from managing to this. And that part-time job, I was able to meet people in the company and now I'm a director at the same company. So I think just being open-minded, stop thinking that everything is going to be a straight path and understanding that, you just don't know what's going to happen in this industry and you just got to keep working. Just keep working on that muscle and be open-minded.
Great. Well, thanks so much. For those that are listening or watching, where can they find you on social media or if they want to get in touch with you?
Yes, so I am at Candace Amos everywhere, Twitter, Instagram, and my email at the Daily Beast is candace.amos@thedailybeast.com. And yeah, that's it.
Great. Well, I'm going to share those in the show notes so you all didn't have to write it down. But thanks again, Candace, for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, consider giving us 5 stars on iTunes. If you're listening to us on YouTube, consider hitting the like button and commenting on what you enjoyed. I'd really appreciate it.